This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with Deborah Sternberg. She's involved with the Young Entrepreneurs Academy of Baton Rouge. Over 7,700 students have graduated from the academy, which was founded in 2004. We'll talk with her about this entity in our community. Also on the show today, Lauren Scott, the veteran economist, was at LSU for many years, and he will talk about the chemical industry's impact in our state. Take a look at the fiscal cliff, which is in the offing a month and a half away, and also, is the Trump tax plan good for Louisiana? And Tracy Fessenden, she is a professor at Arizona State University, the author of Religion Around Billie Holiday. She says the jazz singing sensation, who died six decades ago, was a spiritual individual. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Hope you had a great Mother's Day and fabulous weekend. And glad you're listening to public radio in South Central Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number outside the area. And if you're dialing locally, 297-5633, you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Deborah Sternberg. She, for 12 years, was the president of Starmount Insurance here in Baton Rouge and now has launched a new endeavor with the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. As mentioned as we previewed the show, the Young Entrepreneurs Academy started nationally in 2004 and now has more than 7,700 students who have graduated nationwide. And in Baton Rouge, there is a new chapter, and Deborah Sternberg is the person who is in charge. And it's always a pleasure to share the microphone with you, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as far as the academy and what it does and how it will impact people in this area, tell us what the Young Entrepreneurs Academy is all about.
Sure. So the Young Entrepreneurs Academy of Baton Rouge is open to high school students, so entering 9th through 12th graders. It's a weekly program that will meet at the LSU College of Business, and these students will be taught not only business fundamentals, but they'll take a business idea and be paired with mentors from the community to flesh out a business plan for those business ideas and then actually launch companies with the Secretary of State's office.
So we're talking about high school kids who are in their formative years, and what will be required for somebody to participate?
So what applicants need to do is go online to yeabr.org, and they will be asked to submit short essays about why they're interested in launching a company and submit their transcript and recommendation. And then it's a competitive process, so all of the applications will be screened by those in the education field, and then we will launch our first class in September.
Young people often have better ideas than people who are set in their ways, and sometimes new and innovative ideas come from younger people, and that's what you're striving for, is innovation. This program, as noted, it has a track record now of about 14 years. What are some of the examples of how it's worked in other places?
So there was a 13-year-old girl who didn't like her lacrosse equipment, and so she created different lacrosse equipment and actually competed on Shark Tank on television. And now her company is over $1 million in sales. And there was another student who was required by his high school to wear ties, and he didn't think they were creative enough ties, so he has now launched the chick magnet ties that are sold on Amazon today. So, yes, they come up with very creative
that's
ideas.
That's wonderful, and I hear the president likes to watch Shark Tank. Classes are held Wednesdays, 5 to 8 p.m.? Is that how it's going to work?
That's right, and the classes are actually taught by instructors from the business school.
This will be a three-hour session, one day a week.
Right.
It's not too labor-intensive, but 3 hours a week sometimes can make a big impression.
It's true. So it's not for everyone. There'll be 30 students max from the Capital Region that will be accepted. And it's not just lectures. This is hands-on. They'll go on field trips and meet other business people in the community. It's really building their network and their business.
And you say the classes will be taught by seasoned professionals.
Exactly.
Business school instructors.
That's right. And it's a great opportunity.
And other entrepreneurs.
Exactly.
And it's a competitive application process. So how does it work as far as making the cut?
So do your best and write the best application you can. And you don't have to have a business idea to apply. So that's important to understand. You just need to have the aptitude and energy to create a business, because that's the difference. This is actually creating businesses in the community.
And you need mentors, speakers, you exactly. need people in all aspects of this. Does that work the same way as the application process to be a part of it as a kid?
So we need everyone to be involved, actually. So if you're interested in being a mentor or playing a role in this, there's a place online so to let us know of your interest and what you're able to offer.
And Deborah comes from a family of entrepreneurs, and a family that truly recreated itself after the great department store downtown closed. You formed a company which sold for a lot of money, and you ran it even after it was sold. But making that transition, moving from one line of work to another, is hard to do. How did the Sternbergs navigate that successfully?
So, you know, I've really gone from different, you know, career paths mm-hmm. along the way, and this seemed like a logical one. I actually got interested in it in starting a pipeline program for entrepreneurs in high school about 5 years ago when my son met Charlie D'Agostino in a Shark Tank type experiment, and Charlie D'Agostino gave him his business card. And so from then I said to Charlie, we need something to capture this energy in young people.
How did you make this decision to go in this direction?
So in January, when I transitioned away from the insurance company, I called Charlie and said, we're going to launch this. It's time. And it didn't take much for Charlie and I to put our heads together and make it happen.
You and Charlie D'Agostino are the driving forces behind this. Ultimately, when you get rolling, how many students do you anticipate having?
So each academy is a max of 30 students, and then we'll have year after year. So there are opportunities, obviously, in high school for 4 years of an opportunity to be in this academy, so 30 students.
And during these weeks, every Wednesday, will it be a different person instructing them? How does that work?
So there'll be different community leaders coming in and talking about the various aspects, but the instructors will have probably three over the course of the year.
So there'll be a lot of variety.
Yes.
And where will it occur?
It'll be housed in the business school at LSU, and then we'll head out to field trips once a month as well. And there's an investor panel at the end of the program where the students compete for actual dollars into their businesses, and the winner of that community investor panel will actually go to Rochester, New York, where this mm-hmm. Young Entrepreneurs Academy was actually founded, and they'll compete nationally for money as well.
Well, Deborah has a varied background herself. She is a graduate of the Wharton School of Business, also the Columbia Business School, and a BA in Political Science from Columbia University, magna cum laude, 1984. And she worked as the top aide, the person at the side of the man, Dan Rather, for almost 5 years. That must have been quite an experience.
It was a fantastic opportunity. It was great.
And I'm saying this guardedly, but he has not been enveloped in some of the scandals that others have. Charlie Rose, go down the list. Now Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather. Nobody says anything like that. Here's a guy who got run out of a job on a questionable issue, but on this front, he seems to be clean.
Yeah, Dan Rather was a fantastic mentor, great friend. I'm thrilled to see where he's gone even after he's left CBS.
He's still relevant at 86, isn't he?
It's amazing. It's so great to watch what he's doing.
Well, quite often these people, when they're on the air, there's one face they present to the audience, or one voice, and then sometimes away from that, they're not such nice people. Was Rather a nice guy?
He was a great guy.
Really?
We would study the elections, the presidential, gubernatorial, House, Senate elections together, and he was a great mentor. Really a terrific guy.
Did you ever see him just absolutely lose it?
I mean, everyone has a bad day. So, you know, he didn't always agree with the direction, but he would, you know, play the role that he needed to do, and he was always on the mark.
I remember him years ago, before you started working with him, saying that he hated having to lead with the O.J. Simpson story night after night, just absolutely hated it. And he made his voice heard, and it was rejected. And he said, do I want to die in this ditch? Is this where I want to take the stand? Because he knew that if he didn't do what they wanted, he probably would lose his job. And he did what they wanted.
I think every anchor probably has, I mean, they all have their own opinions about how things should be. But everyone has a job as well.
Well, he is best known, perhaps, for his work on election nights. And you were with him in the election of 2000, the election of all elections.
It was something else.
Albert Gore and George Bush and several networks, including CBS, originally called the election the Florida for Gore, which would have given him the election. And then Fox, which, of course, was the first to call it for Gore, and CBS and others had to recant. That must have been one of those nights where you thought, oh, my God, this is horrible.
Exactly. I mean, there's not much more to be said about that. It was a memorable night on many counts, and the hanging chad was such a night.
Well, we have some of Dan Rather's pearls from that night. Allie, let's go to this as we head to the break. Dan Rather, election night 2000.
Melted faster than ice cream in a microwave. Close only counts with hand grenades and horseshoes, so close may not be good enough. For one thing, the poles have been veering and wobbling so much that neither NASA nor the Russian Cosmodrome can track them in some cases. And we said earlier in the evening at one point that Governor Bush would probably be as mad as a rain-domed rooster. You know the old saying, bad data in, bad data out. The hour of decision may be drawing near, underscoring may, and don't bet the trailer money on it yet.
Well, the word goofy comes to mind, but might be a tad strong, but I'm not so sure. Too early to say he has the whip hand, but certainly things are shaded toward him. The good book says the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but as a reporter, you have to say that's the way to bet it. At any rate, one night they counted those absentee ballots.
All right, that's Dan Rather 2000, and we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar is producing today. Your numbers locally 297-5633 and outside the area 877-217-5757. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Dr. Lauren Scott, the best-known economist in Louisiana who has a new study on the chemical industry, and of course we'll hit him on a few other topics as well. We're closing with Deborah Sternberg, who is now head of the Young Entrepreneurs Academy, starting in September, a program that transformed high school students into confident entrepreneurs. It's now 14 years old with 7,700 graduates across the country, and Baton Rouge will have one starting in September. And for those who perhaps missed the opening round with you, Deborah Sternberg, for those who'd like more information about being a mentor or a student, the best way to do this is to...
Please go online to www.yeabr.org.
Okay, and a listener, Anne, asks about the number of chapters around the country. Do you know how many there are right now?
There are over 160 around the country, so we're thrilled to be a new chapter here.
And another listener asks, how did you get that gig with Dan Rather? How did you get that job?
I interned when I was at school in New York. I interned at CBS, and then once I graduated, they offered me a job covering domestic news to start with, and then I worked my way up.
Did you stay in touch with him?
I stay in touch with his executive producer to see what they're up to.
Okay. Well, good to see you. Good luck with the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. We'll have you back soon for an update.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deborah. And we're joined now by Dr. Lauren Scott, who is a man, as we know, who probably is the best-known economist in Louisiana and maybe one of the best-known in the United States. He's been not only on this show many times, but on MSNBC, CNBC, Bloomberg, several stations and national publications like the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, USA Today, the Los Angeles Times. I could go on and on. Even the Moscow Times, these entities have quoted Dr. Lauren Scott, who has issued a new report on the state's chemical industry. And it goes without saying that this is a big part of Louisiana's economy, but how big is it, Dr. Scott?
Well, it is big, Jim. By the way, congratulations on your induction to the LSU Alumni Hall of Fame. That's just a great honor for you, and we're very proud of you as an ex-LSU person.
Thank you.
I think a good way to put this is if you went to a statewide Chamber of Commerce meeting, or you went to a Rotary Club meeting the statewide and looked around the room, one out of every seven persons in that room would owe their job to the presence of the chemical industry in the state. If you went to a state...
Hold on. One out of seven?
One out of seven That's exactly right. And this is the largest manufacturing employer in the state. And really, the numbers on the employment of the chemical industry are grossly understated because it leaves out the contractors. If you put the contractors in there, the number gets even huger. So it is a big number. And because the industry, as you know, people who drive by these, for example, on the way to the airport in Baton Rouge, you look up, there's a lot of machinery, there's a lot of equipment, there's a lot of pipes and things like this. So there's a lot of maintenance, repair, construction, and things like that that are associated with this industry that creates a lot of extra jobs that that you don't normally see in an apparel manufacturing facility or a fabricated metals facility and that sort of thing. And then secondly, of course, these are the highest wage sector, some of the highest wage sectors in our economy. Matter of fact, it kind of battles with the refining industry for the number one highest wage industry in the manufacturing sector of the state. So it's very high wage and very high multiplier effect. So it's a big deal.
It's largely a South Louisiana phenomenon.
It is, but there are 53 of our 64 parishes have some kind of chemical industry associated with it. But it's heavily located, heavily concentrated on the river between the old bridge here in Baton Rouge and the mouth of the Mississippi, and then over in the Lake Charles area along the Calcasieu Ship Channel. The primary reason for that is one of the major projects we make are the basic chemicals, the first stage chemicals, which we then ship to, we ship about $9 billion worth of that to the rest of the world. And so access to the Gulf of Mexico is very, very important. Now, we do have, you know, places like you go up to Alexandria, you're in a Procter & Gamble, which is actually a chemical firm. It makes soaps. And then next to it is an outfit called Plastic Packs, which makes the products, makes the containers that the P&G products go into. And so they're just kind of all over the state, but the greatest concentration by far is in the southern part of the state.
And you note that when you travel to Baton Rouge, first time you get off a plane and leave the airport, you look to the right and there are all these plants and you think, my goodness, this is it. This is the center of the economy, and it is a huge part of the East Baton Rouge Parish economy. But there are two parishes, you note, that have even more jobs in the industry than does Baton Rouge.
That's correct. If you go over to Calcasieu Parish, which is huge. I mean, that is a big industry in Calcasieu Parish. And then, you almost got me on the second one. I can't remember the second one off the top.
I think it's Ascension.
It's Ascension. That's correct. Ascension Parish, that's right. Because you have the big BASF complex down there. You have the Methanex, new methanol terminals down there. So it is, like I say, it's very big. But Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge is, I think, number four in the state. It is huge. Of course, the other one is Iberville, which is right across the river from us, where the big Dow complex is. And so our particular area, because of our access to the Gulf of Mexico and to the river, has been historically very important for us.
How significant is the environmental concerns that go with this industry?
Well, I think if you look, we are now made it across the line in terms of being okay from an ozone standpoint. So I think if you look at things like air quality, most of the air quality measures that you will get out of a DEQ or the EPA will show that the air quality efforts have been going down, down, down. These companies have been investing hundreds of millions of dollars in environmental upgrades over the last several years. And I think especially going all the way back to the 70s. And so you've seen, even though the standards for ozone have been raised and raised and raised, their investments in environmental equipment have allowed us to be in compliance, which was a really difficult thing to pull off and a very expensive thing for the industry to pull off over time.
Well, the industry is here, and it's not going anywhere, and it does provide a lot of jobs, and there are, of course, rules and regulations that the industry adheres to, but this will always be a concern about whether or not the trade-off is worth the investment. That investment, Lauren Scott, which governor was most responsible for all these plants being brought to Louisiana?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, the first big surge occurred back in the 1960s. And so whoever was that, I guess that would be McKinthon back during those times. You had a big growth period then. And then right now, we are in a historically huge growth period, like nothing that, frankly, I've ever seen before. And you and I have been talking together for a very, very long time. I've been watching the economy for about four decades, and I've never seen anything like what's going on right now. And that is largely because of some weird things that are happening in the natural gas market. Our natural gas prices are historically very low. We have just an ocean of natural gas in the United States right now, and that's the key input into most of these chemical firms' products. But the problem is the problem for the rest of the world is that if you're the other chemical firms in the EU and in Japan, their natural gas prices are still very high. And as a result, what is happening is if you look at the world demand for chemicals, the pie is not growing real fast, but our share of that pie is growing like crazy because they can't possibly compete with us at those natural gas prices. So we have like 100 and I think the numbers are like $170 billion worth of projects right now that have been announced, and about half of those are underway, and half of them are still at the engineering stage.
We've got some folks waiting in line to talk with Dr. Lauren Scott, who for many years was trolling the campus of Louisiana State University, where he headed the economics department and made it one of the top in the world, and he is now a private economist who consults business and industry, and he has a study that shows that the chemical industry will produce more than $1.5 billion in local property tax rolls over the next 4 years. That's in Louisiana. We'll talk with him about this and more when we return after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Dr. Lauren Scott is with us, one of the foremost economists in the United States. He's based in Baton Rouge, came this way many years ago from the great state of Oklahoma, and he is assessing the Louisiana chemical industry, saying it supports $80 billion in annual sales for businesses in the state, and we'll talk with him about a few other matters as we move along. If you have something on your mind, 877-217-5757. We start with Jim and Walker. Hi, Jim. You're on the air with Dr. Lauren Scott.
Good morning, gentlemen. I know there has been a lot of pros and rah-rah going on about the chemical industry so far, but I haven't heard any mention of of Cancer Alley. So can we talk about the downside of chemical plants?
All right. We did mention the environmental concerns. There is this mantra that has been on for many years calling this area Cancer Alley, and it does have a higher concentration of many types of cancer than other parts of the United States. Has there been a direct link to the chemical industry, Dr. Scott?
Jim, I actually have not looked at that in several years. The last time I looked at that, there was my research I looked at, it was a doctor with the LSU Med School down in New Orleans, but he looked at this area between Baton Rouge and New Orleans and had this unfortunate name, the Cancer Alley, and he found that it was primarily due to a unusual amount of smoking and an unusual amount of high-fat food eating. Not only were people starting to smoke earlier, they're smoking filterless cigarettes at the time, and that was the primary that was the primary reason for the elevated cancer rates. Now, honestly, I have to tell you, I haven't looked at it recently, but again, if you look at virtually, I think you'd be hard pressed to find measures of environmental quality that have gotten worse, say since the 1970s. Most of them have improved very not only a little bit but very dramatically. So, I would be surprised, but I haven't looked at the numbers, honestly. I would be surprised if it could be associated with the chemical industry.
Patrick on Blue Bonnet. Patrick, you're on the air with Dr. Lauren Scott.
Yeah, just so you know, I work in industry. We got plenty of wildlife. We got baby geese out here at Westlake out in the front. So I don't see where industry impacts the environment like your last caller says. If anything, I think we protect it. We work hand in hand with it. That being said, my biggest concern is a lot of our wealth is going, you know, I see a lot of the wealth in East Baton Rouge moving to Ascension Parish. And what concerns me is when these neighborhoods stop industry in East Baton Rouge, like the barge facility that was stopped by John Delgado last year, where they rezoned the property without property owner consent and stopped. And then you see it in Iberville Parish, and these neighborhoods stop industry from coming here. I guess I'd like to know what your guess thoughts on that. I mean, because this is what brings wealth into our state is industry. And if we kill industry by by zoning, not allowing any more industry, that's how do we bring wealth into our state? I mean,
all right. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you. Good to hear from you, Patrick. Dr. Scott?
Well, thanks for those comments. Let me, as an economist and as somebody who talks to economic development people all the time, to me, the issue of where you're going to locate is basically a matter of math. Somewhere in the bounds of these companies, there's an accountant or a finance person figuring the rate of return on equity of here versus some other place. And frankly, as Jim pointed out earlier, our greatest concentration here is along the southern part of the state where we have this access to the Gulf. Our problem here is that we are in direct competition with Texas. And the problem there is that Texas, when you look at virtually any ranking like business climate, Texas number two, us number 40, legal climate, Texas 39, we're the worst in the country, which is something we really need to address. Transportation, higher education, K through 12, they're way better than us. They have no personal corporate income tax, no tax on manufacturing equipment. I mean, it just goes on and on. So we're constantly in competition with them. And so what the one kind of tool that we have to help offset that the advantage they have is the industrial tax exemption program. And that's the thing that's kind of under attack, especially in East Baton Rouge Parish, which I think is very, very short-sighted, unfortunately, and is something that, you know, a lot of people think that people just come here, they're going to make the investment anyway. I think that's silly economics. I don't think anybody in the finance or economics department or any economic developer would ever argue that. So we've got to stay in competition. And I think the key way to do that is through the ITIP, as it's called. And it's very much under attack right now.
All right. Lynn in Melrose. Lynn, good morning. Good to hear from you, Lynn.
Good morning, folks. I guess I'm not surprised, but I'm very disappointed that your guest has not even whispered about the elephant in the room, which is climate change and sea level rise and other flood risk increases that are really a threat to the whole southern part of the state, especially the southeastern part of the state, the Deltaic Plain. And our state climatologists won't even mention it. Neither will weather meteorologists on commercial TV stations. It's embarrassing. I mean, this is a real threat to Louisiana. It's not cancer. It's a loss of landscape at an extraordinary level. And the context in which we're trying to put together a restoration program, again, this is the point that we're part of a global system. And unless global emissions of carbon dioxide are reduced, it's hopeless. And why we can't get that message out is beyond me. We have legislators who mostly think climate change is a hoax.
All right. Dr. Scott, what about the debate over climate change? Thank you, Lynn, for calling. Good to hear from you. Is this a valid concern with these plants certainly potentially being vulnerable if the coast continues to move closer and closer inland?
Yeah, I think from looking at a map of Louisiana and actually from discussions with a National Merit Scholar at LSU, James Coleman, the problem with the vanishing coastline, I think, doesn't have anything to do with climate change. I think it has everything in the world to do with the fact that we diked up the Mississippi River. And if you just look at a map, I mean, you don't have the vanishing coastline over near Lake Charles, do you? You don't have it there. It's okay there. The problem is all the areas where the Mississippi River used to flow. So I think that's that. The other thing about the to your caller, the reason people are skeptical about the climate change is I would just urge you to go back and Google what the headline said on the first Earth Day about 33 years ago. It's a very interesting little thing to do. Go back and Google what the headline said. The headline said, man-made global cooling is going to destroy the Earth if we don't do something about it.
Well,
that's what they said. And then, of course, in the 90s, it became man-made global warming, and then the globe quit warming, and then it became something which, to me, is a very unscientific term, climate change.
Are you debunking global warming?
I think there's a huge – I think people need to understand that this is a huge multi-billion dollar industry that is mainly funded by governments. And I am skeptical about it. Number one, I taught forecasting for 33 years at LSU. And so I know something about forecasting. And I know, for example, that forecasting the price of oil is the second most difficult thing in the economy.
You're not a scientist, neither am I, by the way, but neither one of us is a scientist, and most of the scientists are in concurrence that there is global warming and sea level rise, and that these are factors that will imperil Louisiana perhaps more than any other state.
Well, I mean, I use the scientific method in all my work, so I consider myself a scientist. And I can give you a list of hundreds of thousands of scientists who think it's bunk. So I don't agree that there's great consensus on this. I think that again.
Wouldn't you say there are far more scientists on the other side of you on this, though, Dr. Scott?
It depends on how you define scientists. Again, I mean, if I showed you a graph of what has happened to the climate for the last 2,000 years. And ask you, should I believe people who say they can forecast that into the future, 30 years into the future, and we should change all of our taxes and all of our liberty on the basis of our ability to forecast that line in the future? You'd think I was crazy. As a matter of fact, if I tried to say I could forecast oil prices 30 years in the future, you look at a graph, if it's a historical line, you would say I was crazy. I mean, nobody can forecast that. And I think that's equally true of climate and weather. And so I don't know. As somebody who's again taught forecasting, I think you look at people's record in forecasting, and their record in forecasting has been awful.
All right, Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Scott.
Yeah, Doctor. Were the cuts to higher ed and health care during the Jindal administration insufficient, or should the chemical industry pay more in taxes in order to alleviate the budget problem?
He's
asked whether the chemical industry should pay more in taxes to alleviate budget challenges we're having in Louisiana.
Well, at the very minimum, the industry already pays $1.1 billion. Okay? If you go to a statewide meeting, the PTA meeting, and look around the room, 4 out of every 10 teachers' salaries is paid just by local government taxes, not state government taxes. This industry pays a lot of money, and it pays a huge amount of money in property taxes. You know, the highest-paying property taxpayer who writes out a check to any local government in this state is ExxonMobil here in Baton Rouge. Writes out a check for $32 million, almost $33 million last year, enough to pay the salaries of almost 60% of all the public school teachers in our parish. So, you know, the idea that they're not paying taxes is absurd.
No, I think the question is whether they're paying enough taxes.
Well, I mean, that gets us back to one of our original discussions, and that is, remember, we want them to continue to expand here. I think we want them to continue to expand here.
All right, hold tight. We'll spend a bit more time with Dr. Lauren Scott when we return. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're back after this two-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. The well-known economist, Dr. Lauren Scott, is with us for a few more moments. We've been talking primarily about the chemical industry, but of course, at the state capitol, there is this fiscal cliff that's in the offing in a month and a half unless something's done to address the budget. And a good question from a listener, Tracy, at the capitol, asked Dr. Scott, why are we having such dire economic considerations amid this economic growth that you're touting in the chemical industry and in other places? What's going on?
Well, the biggest problem is the oil patch. I mean, if you look at Lafayette and Houma, and especially in Shreveport, too, as it turns out, I mean, they are just in a terrible, terrible funk. To give you a kind of a reference point, during the Great Recession, we call it, back in 2008, the U.S. economy lost 6.1% of its jobs. Houma's lost 16% of its jobs. Lafayette's lost 10% of its jobs. And Shreveport, I think the last time Shreveport group, their peak was back in 2009 or so. So you've got these pockets in the Louisiana economy that are just in the tank. And matter of fact, it was such a tank that the state just finished up a 28-month recession. We were basically in recession 15, 16, and 17 because of the oil patch. The recession would have been much, much worse had it not been for the fact that there was great growth going on in the Lake Charles area, which is actually one of the fastest growing areas in the United States because of what was going on in chemicals. And because of the good growth that was going on here, the Baton Rouge area, again, associated with chemicals. So we would have been really in the tank had it not been for the fact that the chemical industry is growing the way
all
it
right.
was.
Another listener notes that the price of oil is now more than $70 per barrel. In the old days, this would have been perhaps a panacea and not as much anymore. But how much does that help the cause when budget considerations are being analyzed?
Well, it certainly helps. It certainly helps the money we bring in from sales taxes, royalties, and rentals, and those sorts of things. It helps on that side. Our difficulty here is that oil production in Louisiana has been falling, and the other difficulty is that the Houma and Lafayette economies, in particular, depend upon what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. And unfortunately, to do a project in the Gulf of Mexico, you're talking about a 6 or 7 year project and hundreds of millions of dollars to invest out there. So what they have to see is they have to see the prices at 70 and stay at 70 for a while. They have to believe that it's going to stay there and not drop down to 30 like it did back in, I think it was in 2015. So it's going to take a spell for us. It's helping right now on the service taxes that we are collecting, but we really need recovery in Lafayette and Houma for this thing to really start helping out the state budget a lot.
Charlotte in New Iberia. Charlotte, you're on the air with Dr. Scott.
Thank you, Jim. Dr. Scott, I have found that the statement you made about the chemical industry not causing people's ill health disagrees with or is in direct contrast to what news reports have been given over the years, because in poor areas where the plants have been located in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and in the Texas area have a large percentage of people with ill health, and it's not because of smoking. Thank you, Jim, for letting me contribute.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Now, I hear you, and I think that's I would need to see, like I say, I quoted a study that was older, and I haven't seen a newer study. But I would want to see somebody from like the LSU Med School look at this. Rather than just newspaper reports on this, because you see a report of a particular community having a lot of cancer, something like that. I don't know if it's more than the average or less than the average. I don't know from a newspaper report. That's why I would like to see a good scientific study on that, and I'm more than open to listening to that.
On an earlier appearance on our program, you indicated you were steadfastly against these tariffs that President Trump has enacted. But on the other hand, I would imagine there are parts of his economic plan that you like. On the whole, how do you judge him 16 months into his tenure as president?
Well, I mean, there's good news and there's bad news in it. Number one, the good news front is the deregulation activity. That's been very significant and very important, I think, in terms of reducing costs to firms and causing them to hire more people, produce more output. So the deregulation front has been very good. I think that the reduction in taxes is going to be very good, and I think you're just beginning to see the impact of that. The scary part has been the international trade part, as you and I have talked about before. I think the idea of imposing the tariffs on everybody, on steel and aluminum, was very, very disconcerting, and could lead to something very bad in terms of our economic growth. But he is steadily backed off, for example, with virtually all of our trading partners except China. And it looks like this was more, of course, if you want to learn what's really going on in the economy, you ask your barber, right? And so my barber kept patting me on the shoulder and saying, Lord, don't worry, don't worry. He's just a negotiating ploy to work with China. And China is our biggest problem. We import four times more from China than we sell to China, whereas we're almost on a par with Canada, and we import a little bit more from Mexico. So the international trade part is concerning. But what's going on the taxes and deregulation side, I think, is very helpful. And I think you start to see it in the numbers. I mean, we've had 3%, some 3% growth numbers, and I think most of the forecasts that I'm seeing now for the rest of this year show numbers approaching 3% per year plus, as opposed to the 2.1% that we experienced in the Obama years.
Well, we're probably going to have $1 trillion deficit for the first time in a while. That is an age-old concern, and Donald Trump mm-hmm. was one of those expressing a lot of concern about it on the campaign trail. Has that gone out the window?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I have about as much confidence as anybody listening here that we're going to do anything about the deficit until something really tragic hurts. Someone once told me, there was an economist one time said the easy way to solve the deficit is to raise the salaries of all the senators and congressmen to $1 million a year if there is no deficit. Now, if there is a, you know, $10 billion deficit, mm-hmm. then you lower their salary to $900,000. If there's a $50 billion deficit, you lower it to $500,000. And basically, his argument was that deficit will go away and nothing flat. But I don't know. That is a problem, and I'm not going to minimize the issue there. But every president that's mm-hmm. ever been around, I think, has contributed to this problem, going all the way back to a deficit hawk like Ronald Reagan. They just don't. They talk a good talk, but they don't.
Well,
really take care of the problem.
Bill Clinton did leave us with a surplus, but he's the only one who addressed this as he said he would. Now, $1 trillion is a whole lot of money. A whole lot of money.
Yes.
But
yes.
I just read last week that student debt in the United States is now $1.5 trillion. With people having this kind of debt in our country, what does that do to the great land of ours as far as the consumer activity?
Yeah, well, that's not that. That obviously is a problem for those people who use that vehicle for getting their education, and many times they were spending that kind of money to invest in a degree that's really not going to help them very much in terms of paying off that debt. So, I mean, that is a problem for individuals, I think. But if you look at the economy as a whole, the economy is certainly growing much faster than it used to be. So that means there's going to be more job opportunities and hopefully higher, and almost commensurate with that, higher wage rates, which at least help people start to address that a lot better than they did during slow growth years.
Are you saying inflation, at least a little bit of it, may actually be a good thing?
Well, I think you're going to have some inflation, but not very much. All the forecasts that I've seen indicate that inflation is very much under control and is not going to be an issue. That's why your interest rates are so low right now for those folks.
But they have been going up.
They've been going up, but look at how much they've been going up. If you look at a graph of interest rates from 1960 forward, what interest rates are doing now is they're trivial. I mean, they're talking about a 0.25% increase at a time. If you go back to the early 80s, Jim, you and I are both old enough to remember this, the prime rate was 21.5%. It was 21.5%. But back then we had interest rates rising 3 or 4 or 5% in a year, not 0.25% or 0.5% in a year. So they're going up, but I don't think they're certainly not going up enough to hurt, say, the housing industry. Your 30-year mortgage interest rate is still, if it goes up, it might go up half a percentage point or 3/4 percentage point. So it's not going. The interest rate and inflation rate is not enough to be an issue right now in the economy, I think. I haven't seen any forecast that suggests that that's going to be a problem.
Dr. Scott, thank you for joining us. Always good to talk with you.
Jim, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
See you soon. And Tracy Fessenden will be with us tomorrow to talk about her work regarding the legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday. Vote today at the Capitol due on Harris and whether Harris gets the deal it's seeking, with 21 lobbyists pushing for it. Also on the non-unanimous jury in Louisiana. For Ali, I'm Jim. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.